Gospel of John, John chapter 6, verses 1 to 15 this morning. I read about a preacher who the very next Sunday announced that he was going to preach a message on Noah and on Noah's ark. And some mischievous boys in the church got an idea in their head. Knowing in advance what his subject was going to be, they found his Bible, and they glued a few of the pages of that particular story together. And so the pastor got up in the pulpit to begin the message the following week, and he began to read the text. And this is what he read. Noah took unto himself a wife, and she was, and then he turned the page to read, and she was cubits long, 50 cubits wide, and 30 cubits high. He paused and he read it again. And then he looked and said, you know, I've been studying the Bible for almost 50 years, but there are still some things that are hard to believe. Well, you know, when you read the Bible, and I think the older I get, the more it's true. The more you read the Bible, there are those things that just seem so profound and so hard to believe. And we come to one of those things this morning in the miracle of Jesus feeding the 5,000. Now, as we go through the text and the passage and the book of John, you must remember again John's purpose that he expresses in John 20, verses 30 to 31. He says that Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples. How about that? In the book of John, he records 7 miraculous signs. So he's being very selective. And he chooses these 7 miraculous signs because he wants to make a case that Jesus Christ is indeed God in flesh. But John is careful to say, but there's many, many more signs and miracles that he performed. But these signs that I've recorded for you are written that you might believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Christ. That you might believe that he is the Son of God. And that believing, you might have life, eternal life in his name. So that's the broad overriding as we go through this book. But in this particular passage, there's even broader applications than that. We come to this passage, and I ask the question of you, do you have problems in your life? Do you have problems in your life sometimes that just seem beyond your scope to deal with? Problems in your life that seem overwhelming? Problems in your life that you just don't seem to have the necessary resources to deal with? Do you run into things in your life that are just seemingly impossibilities from every human perspective? Do you deal with issues in your life, feelings of inadequacy? I'm not up to the task. I don't have the gifts, the talents. And do you sometimes find yourself in the face of the odds that you think are against you, just kind of acquiescing, surrendering to the circumstances, giving up, and consequently never investing anything of yourself? Well, if that fits you in any way, then John chapter 6, verses 1 to 16, is a passage that is for you. It begins in verse 1, and it said, sometime after this, Jesus crossed to the far shore of the Sea of Galilee, that is, the Sea of Tiberias, and a great crowd of people followed him because they saw the signs he had performed by healing the sick. Then Jesus went up on a mountain and sat down with his disciples. The Jewish Passover festival was near. I think he may mention the Passover festival because even though this was North Galilee, there would have been many pilgrims heading from Galilee south on their way to Judea for the required Passover. So this might have actually accentuated the presence of the crowds in this passage. When Jesus looked up and saw a great crowd coming toward him, he said to Philip, where shall we buy bread for these people to eat? He asked this only to test him, for he already had in mind what he was going to do. Philip answered him, it would take more than half a year's wages to buy enough bread for each one to have a bite. Another of his disciples, Andrew Simon, Peter's brother, spoke up. Here's a boy with five small loaves and two small fish. But how far will they go among so many? Jesus said, have the people sit down. There was plenty of grass in that place, and they sat down. About 5,000 men were there. Glad it wasn't Florida. They'd be sitting in a pile of fire ants, probably. Jesus then took the loaves, gave thanks, and distributed to those who were seated as much as they wanted. He did the same with the fish. When they had all had enough to eat, he said to his disciples, gather the pieces that are left over, let nothing be wasted. So they gathered them and filled 12 baskets with the pieces of the 5 barley loaves left over by those who had eaten. After the people saw the sign Jesus performed, they began to say, surely this is the prophet who is to come into the world. Jesus, knowing what they intended, that they intended to come and make him king by force, withdrew again to a mountain by himself. Aside from the resurrection of Jesus Christ, this is the only miracle that is recorded in all 4 Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. That tells me that this is a significant miracle in God's eyes and in their minds, and it must have been especially impressive to them. Now, the miracle is frequently referred to as the miracle of the 5,000. But the reality is there were many more people here than 5,000. In Jewish culture of the day, when they counted a crowd, they'd only count the men. And Luke makes that clear. Luke, in his account, mentions that there were 500 besides, he says, women and children. So the majority of scholars would say that, conservatively speaking, there would have been anywhere from 15,000 to 20,000 people fed. Personally, I would probably go beyond that. You've got 5,000 men, you've got at least 5,000 women, I would say, and they were large families in those days. So you may have had a presence of people there exceeding 20,000. Now let's put that into terms that we could understand. Hammond Stadium, Red Sox Stadium, just short distance from here, has a seating capacity of about 9,400 people. So next time you're sitting there, look at that stadium and look at it as a packed stadium and think, wow, Jesus would have fed more than 2 times the capacity of this particular stadium. So again, this was an impressive miracle. And it was a miracle that stood out in the minds of the apostles. The other gospel writers give us additional detail that John doesn't give. John gives some detail they don't give. The other gospel writers give details John doesn't give. We piece it all together, we get a fuller picture. But as we piece it all together, we find the scenario was that it was getting closer and closer toward evening. And the disciples look at the crowds, and they're in a remote place. And so they suggest to Jesus that maybe it's time to send the crowds away, to give them time to go to any surrounding villages to find food, or perhaps even housing as evening approached. But Jesus, you know, they're saying, send the crowds away. But Jesus had a better idea. In Matthew 14, 16, Jesus says, they do not need to go away. You give them something to eat. You know, if I had been there, and Jesus said, you give them something to eat, I would have thought, you must be joking. I would have thought, Lord, you can't be serious. how am I to give them? What Jesus is doing here is he's setting up an impossible situation. And we'll find he's setting up an impossible situation in order to test them. Next time you have an impossible situation in your life, maybe it's God seeking to test you. Now, by definition, I looked it up in a couple of dictionaries and I merged some of the meanings together to make it more profound. But if you look it up in a dictionary, here's my expanded definition from a couple dictionaries of the word impossible. It means not able to occur, exist, be done, or be achieved. Not possible, incapable of being, incapable of occurring, insuperably difficult, hopeless. So let's, again, think about the hopelessness of this situation. Over two times the seating capacity of Hammond Stadium. They're in a remote place. You know, evening is approaching. And Jesus says, you give them something to eat. You buy them some food. That's a totally impossible scenario that he paints for them. And especially considering the time factor. All of this is to happen before nightfall. And there's not a fast food franchise in sight. Just think about the logistics of this situation. Think about the logistics of allocation, acquisition, purchase, preparation, transportation. You know, in the military, they have people who their entire career is centered on acquisition, allocation, purchase, and transportation in order to provide supplies for the armies that we deploy. This was no less of a logistical nightmare than that. And of course, Jesus' question, you know, where can we buy food? You know, that another dimension too, a financial dimension involved. I mean, even if they could dial up Meals on Wheels, even if they could, you know, order takeout from Domino's Pizza, where are they going to get the money for all this? I mean, Philip quickly calculated his mind. You know, Lord, it would take at least a half a year's wages of a working man or a Roman soldier, because a denarius was considered one day's wage, 200 denarii. It would be pushing 7 months, if you calculate it, of a working man's wage, he's saying, and that would probably provide just a single bite for every individual who is here. But John tells us something in this passage that we have read that none of the other gospel writers tell us. It is unique to the gospel of John. John tells us that he said this, verse 6, only to test him. For he knew what he had in mind, and Jesus knew already what he was going to do. So it's a test. It's a setup. And again, we need to look at the trials and the circumstances that sometimes come in our lives that seem beyond our control, that seem impossible, and we feel inadequate to deal with them. You know, sometimes God allows those problems to come into our lives, and he allows them with good intent. He allows them to be a test in our lives, to test our faith, to reveal the faith that is within and to bring it to the surface. Because, you know, there's one thing God values more than anything else, it would seem. God values faith. He values faith more than silver, more than gold. He values your faith. And he brings problems into our lives to bring that faith to the surface, because that's what God values. And that's what gives him the glory, your faith that you place in him. So it's a test. It's a test to reveal their faith. Sometimes we need to look at our problems, our adversity. We need to look at those things as God's curriculum. He's teaching us. Be good students of what God is trying to teach you. So the point being, Jesus is the teacher. He's the rabbi, and he selected 12 men to be his apostles, to be his disciples. And he is in a teaching, mentoring relationship with them for some three and a half years. To this point, he has been teaching his disciples to depend on the power and on the resources of God. And now, he gives them a test. He gives them a task to perform that is beyond their power, that is beyond their resources, something they simply cannot complete on their own. Will they look to themselves for the resources? Or will they look to God? I'm reminded of a king in the Old Testament who was dealing with an impossible situation. There was a vast and a mighty army coming against the armies of Judah, and they were outnumbered. I mean, it was a fair fight. The numbers of the enemy were so vast. And the king gathers the people together, and he says, "This is a vast horde, a vast army coming against us. We don't know what to do." Impossible situation. But that king got the test. He passed the test. He said, "But our eyes are on you." I love that verse. We've all been in those places in our lives where we don't know what to do. But we say, "God, I don't know what to do. My eyes are on you." I wish that Philip and Andrew and the disciples would have followed that example. I wish they would have said, "Lord, I don't know what to do, but my eyes are on you. I've seen what you can do. I've seen the miracle of the water turned to wine. I've seen the miracle of you healing the nobleman's son from a distance of perhaps 20 miles or more. I've seen you heal a paralytic, a man who was paralyzed for some 38 years. I've seen what you can do, Lord. And surely you are able to do something to meet this need." But again, Philip and Andrew, at this particular moment, they failed the test. So you know what happens when you fail a test? You have to be retaught, have to be retested. But God tests our faith, and we see that throughout the Bible. James talks about the testing of our faith, producing patience, endurance. 1 Peter talks about the testing of our faith. In 1 Peter 1:7, he says that trials and difficulties come so that your faith may be proved. It may be tested, proved genuine, proved to be real, and may result in praise, glory, and honor when Jesus Christ is revealed and returns. There's the end game. You're going through troubles, you're going through impossibilities in your life. Put your faith in God. The faith will be surfaced, and it will ultimately be of great value. It will result in praise, glory, and honor when Jesus is revealed. You may have to wait a while for that, but I can guarantee when that time comes and you're experiencing it, you'll be glad you passed that test. You'll be glad you demonstrated faith, because your faith is going to bring praise, glory, and honor to Jesus Christ when he is revealed. It's a new way to look at your trials. God tests our faith, and God tests our faith to reveal three things about us. One thing that tests our faith and is revealed as we go through tests is, do I believe that God cares about me? Even when things aren't going right in my life. Do I understand that God is always with me? Even when he feels distant, even when I feel abandoned, God's almighty power to change my circumstances. These tests, these difficulties in our lives will reveal the answers to those particular questions. Of course, with respect to Philip and Andrew, the irony is that in the face of an impossible situation, the solution was standing right there in front of them. How could they have missed it? You know, the Bible says in the book of Psalms that the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, the world and all they that dwell therein. In Psalm 50, verse 10, it says, "The cattle on 1,000 hills is mine. Every animal in the forest is mine." Standing right in front of them is the God in flesh, who owns a cattle on 1,000 hills. The God who owns every animal in the forest belonging to him. The earth belongs to him. The fullness thereof. The world belongs to him. And all that dwell therein. But the disciples saw only their own limited resources, saw only their own inadequacies. The problem was that they calculated without factoring in Jesus Christ. How many times do we do that in our lives? So often we have what I would call a chicken little mentality. Problems come into our lives without even a thought. We go into a panic. We begin calculating our own resources, our own abilities, our own finances, our own gifts, our own talents, and we're not up to the task. And the sky is falling. We calculate. We fail to stop and take a time out to be still and know that He is God and to calculate Him into the situation. To say, "God, I don't know what to do. I don't have the resources. I don't have the strength. But I know you do. And Lord, my eyes are upon you." Andrew, you know, he's a little different story than Philip. He seems to find a little boy. And I don't know, maybe the little boy came forward and saw the issue and had more faith than the disciples. I don't know how that happened, but he had the 5 loaves of bread, the 2 fish. And when you think about loaves of bread, don't think about, you know, going down to the store and buying 5 loaves of bread. We're talking about little like barley, flat little barley wafers. Barley was the food of a poor man. So he had these 5 little mini flat pancake barley wafers. He had 2, probably were dried fish to preserve them, and they would have been about the size of sardines. So this boy's lunch was probably barely enough to satisfy the needs of that boy. But for whatever reason, Andrew brings that to Jesus Christ. You're beginning to think, well, maybe Andrew is showing some signs of faith here. I mean, if it had been me, I'd say, well, what's the point? It's just 2 little sardines. And 5 little wafers, but he brings it to Jesus anyway, maybe to satisfy the boy. I don't know, but he brings it to Jesus. And you might have hope that he's demonstrating some faith, but then it's shattered because he says, "But Lord, what is so little among so many people?" So for Philip, it was an impossible situation. For Andrew, the resources were just insufficient. Whereas Philip focused on the enormity of the situation, Andrew focused on the fact that there simply was not enough. There were limited resources available. Either way, the problem is still too big for both of them to deal with. And again, we can be the same exact way. Quickly, you look over your problem, you calculate your resources, and you conclude you don't have what it takes. The loaves, the fish, they seem totally inadequate from a human perspective. And from a human perspective, they were inadequate, but not from God's perspective. It's kind of like you got a little, you know, three-year-old boy, like my grandson, Grant. And there's some things for Grant that seem completely impossible from his little perspective. But from my perspective, from the perspective of his grandpa, those things that he deems impossible are easy. No problem. From an adult perspective, they're totally possible. And so it is with God. So often we live our lives on that little three-year-old boy horizontal dimension when we should be living in a vertical dimension with that divine awareness of the presence and the power of Jesus Christ that's available in our lives. If you look at this passage, you find that there's a contrast buried in the passage. Philip says it would take more than a half a year's wages to buy enough bread for each one to have a bite. Meanwhile, Andrew says, "Here's a boy with five small barley loaves and two small fish. How far will they go among so many people?" There's a big but there. But how far will they go among so many people? But by the end of the story, instead of one bite, it says they had as much as they wanted. The word is the idea of filled to capacity. It's that feeling you get after Thanksgiving dinner, when you have to push yourself away from the edge of the table to make more room for your belly. And Andrew says, "But what is so little among so many?" But by the end of the story, they have 12 basketfuls of fish and bread that is left over. See, Jesus proves that he can not only supply your need, but he can provide for your need in an abundance. He can do abundantly, immeasurably, above and beyond all that we ask, all that we think. One author writes, "Miracles are the common currency of heaven. Eating of the 5,000 was just a little loose change, spilling from a hole in its pocket. Impossibilities are solved by miracles, pennies from heaven." And he says, Jesus had a pocket full. Well, what about the disciples? Did they learn anything from all of this? Yes, they did, but it didn't happen right away. In the book of Matthew, we read, and this happened sometime later, but in the book of Matthew, chapter 16, beginning in verse 5, we read, "When they went across the lake, the disciples took bread. 'Be careful,' Jesus said to them, 'be on your guard against the yeast of the Pharisees and Sadducees.' They discussed this among themselves and said, 'It is because we didn't bring any bread.' Aware of their discussion, Jesus asked, 'You of little faith, why are you talking among yourselves about having no bread? Do you not yet understand? Or have you not yet learned? Do you not remember the five loaves for the 5,000 and how many baskets were gathered? Or the seven loaves for the 4,000 and how many baskets were gathered?' You see, Jesus, by this time, expected the disciples would have begun to connect the dots. They had not connected all the dots. They were slow learners, just like we are. But let's, this morning, connect some of these dots. What lessons can we take from the feeding of the 5,000? Well, first of all, that word impossible. You know, impossible was not even a word that you could find in any dictionary that Jesus owned. Impossible was not a word that existed in his vocabulary. Impossibility, again, is only a matter of perspective. In Jeremiah 32:17, the prophet says, "Ah, sovereign Lord, you have made the heavens and the earth by your great power and outstretched arm. Nothing is too hard for you." In Jeremiah 32:27, God says, "I am the Lord God of all mankind. Is anything too hard for me?" In Luke 18:27, Jesus replied, "What is impossible with men is possible with God." You know, one of the things John is striving to do is to connect the dots to the God of the Old Testament. And with these miracles of Jesus, he's trying to make them understand that the Yahweh of the Old Testament that they worshiped is Jesus Christ in their midst, God in flesh among them, acting as God, performing the same feats as God. So Jesus is the God of the impossible. And God wants another lesson from this is not only is God the God of the impossible, but also, again, we've already seen this, that God tests us. So again, your difficulties, your trials, your situations that you're faced with, you know, those are given to you by God to grow your faith, to shape your faith, so that that faith, having been tested, having been surfaced through the trials, through the hardships, will resound to the glory of Jesus Christ on the day that he is manifested in heaven. A third lesson. You must never believe that your resources are too little or too limited to serve God. Sometimes we give up on a task before we start. We might say, to make it simple, you know, there's nothing I can really do to contribute to the life, the vitality of that particular church. I don't have the gifting. I don't have the ability. I'm too inadequate. We come across that all the time. And, of course, we know better. My son Aaron is going to be up in southern Indiana with his family at the end of this week. And he is going to be candidating for a church. And reality has set in. And it's, you know, an intimidating situation for him. And we were discussing it, and he was talking about just the feeling of inadequacy. I knew exactly what he was saying. We all get feelings of it. But there's one thing this passage is teaching us, is that as long as you keep those little gifts and inadequacies in your own hands, nothing's going to happen. But when you take what little you have, that little lunch that you have, and you place those limited gifts, those limited abilities, those limited resources into the hands of Jesus, that's where it makes all the difference in the world. Because when you put it in the hands of Jesus, then it can be multiplied and it can abound for the glory of God. Too often we fail the test. We never even try to see what God can do. But as long as that lunch remained in that little boy's hands, it would never be enough for the crowd. But once that lunch got into the hands of Jesus Christ, it was more than enough. And again, it's the same for you and me. As long as it remains in our hands, it will never be enough. But if you put it into God's hands, it will make it enough. We think, you know, what good am I with so little to offer? Bring it to God. No matter how insignificant you may think your gifts and talents are, God can do abundantly with it. Another lesson here is the Lord can take the little we have, and again, He can make it abound. He can make it abound abundantly with 12 basketfuls left over if we just trust Him and if we just do Him. A hiker, I can kind of relate to this story because I've been in some situations backpacking where it was hot and the canopy was gone and the mountain is high and I've had my last drop of water out of my water bottles and I'm thirsty. And you come to the next place on your little diagram showing where the next shelter is with the next spring. And you're thinking, oh, just a little bit longer, just a little bit longer, just around the next curve, that curve comes, oh, just around that next curve comes, oh, just around that next curve. But you finally get there, and what do you find? You find that spring is dried up. Oh, you're thirsty. Well, the story's told about this hiker, and this hiker was in that thirsty kind of situation. And he comes to an abandoned house. He goes into the abandoned house and he finds one of those old, you know, crank water pumps. He's thirsty. With every last ounce of strength he has, he vigorously pumps that water pump. He pumps until he's exhausted and nothing comes out. Then he happens to notice something that was there all along. It was a jug of water with a cork in the top, and there was a little note attached, written in pencil, and it said, "Use the water to prime the pump." Now he had a decision to make and he wasn't all too sure. Or he could take the contents of that jug, follow the directions carefully, pour it into the pump and prime the pump. Well, he wound up following the directions, priming the pump. And you know what? As a result, he had satisfying water, more than he could ever begin to drink. And before going his way, he filled the jug with water so the next thirsty person could secure water. But he added something to that penciled note. To that penciled note, he said, "Believe me, it really works. You have to give it all away before you can get anything back." What a fitting story. The little boy took a risk. If he gave it away, he would have nothing. But he gave it away. And when he gave it away, he got everything back and more. I believe, you know, I like to believe anyway, that once the 12 baskets were collected, that Jesus handed them over to that boy who gave up his lunch. That's why I like to think. Why do I want to think that? Because in Luke chapter 6, verse 38, we read an amazing principle concerning one's giving to God. It says, "Give, and it shall be given unto you, good measure, pressed down and shaken together and running over. Shall men give into your bosom? For with the same measure that you mete out, with it shall be measured to you again." In other words, if a person will give to God, God naturally, God will give back supernaturally. I think the same principle in this story holds true. This lad gave five loaves and two fishes, but because he willingly gave it to Jesus, he might have walked away, I like to think. Because he willingly gave it to Jesus, I like to think, he might have walked away with 12 basketfuls. Not quite sure how he would have carried it, but I like to think that. Another lesson from this story, Christ uses inadequate people to meet the needs of people. Jesus didn't have to use Philip. He didn't have to use Andrew. He didn't have to use the little boy. He didn't have to use the disciples to distribute the food. He could have done what God did for Moses. He could have just rained down the food from heaven, but he didn't. God chooses to use people to meet the needs of people. God chooses to use inadequate people to meet the needs of people. God used painfully inadequate people. Someone asked Robert Morrison, a famous missionary to China, "Do you really expect to make an impact on that great land?" "No, sir," Morrison replied, "but I expect God to." God delights in using the weak things. God delights in using the nobodies to do great things. There's a story is told of a small town, and a famous violinist was coming to town. He was coming to town to perform a concert, and he was going to perform the concert on an equally famous, cherished, legendary, priceless violin. Everybody was eager to hear the violinist, acclaimed violinist, play on the famous violin. He got up and he gave the concert. And they watched, and it was flawless. And he received a rousing standing ovation that continued for a lengthy period of time. And then after playing on the violin, he did something that totally made no sense whatsoever. Very strange. He took that violin and he smashed it against the podium and he broke it into pieces. And the crowd let out a gasp because they thought he had crushed the famous violin. Then he reached under the podium and he pulled out a very beautiful violin and held it high, and he said, "This is the violin you came to hear, the very famous, rare instrument." He said, "The violin upon which I play tonight was only a very cheap, common instrument." And he said, "I wanted to give the illustration and the lesson that it's not so much the quality of the instrument as it is the touch of the master's hands upon the strings." Well, again, the application to our own lives is clear. No matter who you are, no matter what you've done, no matter how weak you are, no matter how limited your resources may be, given any particular situation, it's not so much the quality of the instrument that matters. That's not the issue. The issue is putting the instrument in the master's hands. And one of the lessons that comes through this passage is put your life, put the instrument, no matter how inadequate, no matter how limited the resources, put it in his hands. As long as it's in your hands, nothing will happen. But put it in his hands. God isn't so interested in your abilities as he is in your activity. Another final lesson as we wrap things up is God is in control. In verse 6 it says, Jesus already knew. Jesus knew all along what he was going to do. And you know what? No matter what situation in your life is, God still knows. Jesus still knows exactly what he is going to do. You know, you can spin yourself into a frantic panic, but God, Jesus, He still knows what He's up to. He knows what He's going to do. Ultimately, He's going to deliver. Ultimately, He's going to provide. Ultimately, He's going to bless. Now listen, you may have to wait a while. And that's a hard lesson to learn. I'm bringing my little grandson Grant back into the picture. It's amazing to me how quickly kids can pick up on things. Which brings another story to mind that doesn't even relate. The other day, my son Aaron was doing his daddy thing and just being silly and singing real loud and annoyingly at the top of his voice. And my littlest granddaughter says, "Dude, will you be quiet?" But Grant, you tell him to wait, and you know what he says? He says, "Waiting is hard." He did it yesterday. They stopped by to visit, and, "Wait a minute, Grant. Waiting is hard. Waiting is hard." No matter how old you are, we may have to wait. We may have to experience some discomfort along the way. Otherwise, it wouldn't qualify as a test. We may have to face fear. We may have to face uncertainty. It's all part of the test. But God knows. He knows. He knows what He's going to do. Peter circumstances. Job says, "He knows the way I take." He knows. Philip and the rest of the disciples simply needed to learn the lesson that God is in control. Let's pray. Our Father, we thank